Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We come your way every week, and we broadcast live. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We're rebroadcast on A2Zen.fm, and we are archiving these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. Lots of opportunities for you to hear the program. You can go to the radio shows page, listen to, download the interview, and share it with your friends if it's something that is meaningful to you. I would highly, highly recommend that. If you'd like to support this program, we have a page. It's called the Missions page, and you scroll down to the bottom after reading what our mission is all about. And if it vibrates with you, resonates with you, and you'd like to be a part of this work, there's ways for you to do that as well. So we hope that you will check out our website, but we also hope that you will do more than that. We hope you will go to the websites of our guests. That's where the real information is. The information that I have is nothing more than a portal that leads you where you might want to go as far as our guests, the subject matter, the materials, books, movies, CDs, seminars, webinars, all of the other terminology that is out there as well. So we certainly hope that you will take advantage of that. Today is a very special program as we are talking about more than just an organ in the body. Stay with us.
The heart. A great mystery, a life-giving organ, the new frontier of human evolution. Our ancestors were connected to the lifeblood of every living thing. Everything for them was animated, pulsing, breathing, connected, alive. Now we are remembering this connection, entering into what is for us uncharted territory. Science allows us to journey to the stars, solve great mysteries of life, and create a vision of what can be. This knowledge is pointing us to an even greater wisdom that began with our ancestors and now invites us each to pave a new way.
And that is the voice of our guest, and her name is Rana Prince, and she is the writer and producer of the documentary, which is entitled Sacred Journey of the Heart. And Rana, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here.
In watching the DVD, watching the movie unfold, and of course recognizing many folks in it who are part of an ongoing, I'll call it movement, on the planet. I was going to say in this country, but it's literally globally, who are really striving and working toward what we like to refer to as a better life, looking for those new ways of living, as we put it. And one in particular that you had on the in the documentary, Greg Braden, we've had him on the program I don't know how many times, but he kind of opened the door for us several years back when he started talking about the heart, and it's more than just a muscle that pumps the blood. Science, this is what's fascinating to me, and I'd like for you as we get into this, and I want to also, we'll talk about your part in the film and how this all came to be, but I want to start with the I'll call it the lead actor, if you will, the heart.
Right.
Science has shown us just how integral, I'm not even sure I pronounced that correctly, it is in our lives on all levels. Can you enlighten us a little bit more about that as you have discovered?
Yes, that's a great way to start the show for the film that's centered around the lead actor, the heart. And you know, I started out, you know, having a sense of the sort of like the energetic heart, just because I had been teaching and as an intuitive counselor and coach, you know, for a number of years, and saw that there was a lot of power when we accessed the heart. Then, in endeavoring to do the film, I learned that there was so much more to it than just the energetic heart that we thought was metaphorical, and the literal heart that most people think about as just an organ of the circulatory system that pumps blood. And we all understand how important the heart is, because, you know, the heart attack statistics tell the state and condition of the physiological heart of human beings now, just as number one killer for both men and women. So, you know, I knew I was going to learn a few things, but what I was surprised to learn is the other physiological roles of the heart besides the circulatory system. I learned from the scientists that I interviewed at the Institute of Heart Math that it's classified now as part of the endocrine system. So our heart excretes its own hormone. A lot of people aren't aware of that, and it's also part of the neurological system in terms of the neurocardiology, a whole field of study. So the heart really has its own intelligence, its own brain, if you will, that communicates to the brain and communicates a lot of information to the brain, not just a little, that we could get into that later. So I learned all these additional functions of the heart, and then we went into the healing of the heart, the emotional heart in the film, and then we did get in and touch on the energetic heart, which is not as, I think it's Dr. Joe Dispenza says in the film, it's not a metaphorical analogy, it's an actual reality, and the film goes on to explain exactly how the human energetic heart overlaps with the earth and what we can really do with the power in our heart.
I find it really extraordinary, too, because the messages that I have received over the years from childhood about the importance of the heart, you know, I mean, it's a valuable thing, obviously, for pumping the blood. But, you know, you need to come from your heart and heart-centered this. And I mean, all of those different terminologies and phrases, especially as what started out as what I, from my observations, what started out as the New Age movement back in the 70s and 80s, and it's actually transformed. I don't see it in that context anymore because it's so much bigger than that. Are actually showing to be more true, as we're talking here on the program, as you have shared in the movie, than anybody could actually really understand. I would even throw in one of these childhood phrases, for example, that I kind of grew up with as well. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. I found out was a lie, that it's actually just the reverse, that the words that we choose and depending upon where they're coming from and the intent that we use can make all the difference in the world. We're also finding out, too, and I want you to talk to us a little bit about your understanding, your discovery of our interconnectedness. I came across an author and a book not too long ago, and this particular author is talking about this since passed, but the book's still very popular. Talking about this whole business of getting away from connected collectivism and getting back to individualism. And I saw a documentary on this woman, and I've seen the movies based upon the book. And I thought, well, that's an interesting point. Might have been a great idea back in the 50s or 60s, but we've gone so far beyond that, that now collectivism isn't even the right word. We're all interconnected. Can you elaborate further on your discoveries through the work that you do? And by the way, I should let our listeners know, too, that as you've already mentioned, you know, you're a life coach and you're also the founder of Modern Mastery. We'll want to talk a little bit about that, as well as the Global Wholeness Corporation. And you also hold workshops and seminars. I mean, you're all about working towards, healing oneself and communities in the world, as well as bringing wholeness and wellness to everyone. But let's talk about that interconnectedness that you found.
Well, the interconnectedness part is really an interesting part of the film. We approach it from two ways, both the scientific and then the ancient spiritual traditions, because, you know, when you get into a spiritual practice, there's a lot of information about unity and oneness, and yet we have these separate bodies and these lives that we lead that look not so interconnected. So when I was working with the Institute of Heart Math, the premier research scientific-based institute in Northern California, Dr. Roland McCready started talking about the connection between the human heart signal, the electromagnetic signal coming from the heart, as being a direct overlap with the electromagnetic signature of the Earth. He said it's not approximate, it's exact. And he made some other connections about the human brain waves and the ionosphere and things. And then Greg Braden went on to explain in the context of the film that there's two geosynchronous satellites that have been orbiting Earth for quite a while, measuring this electromagnetic field of the Earth, just, you know, research and data. And then on a particular day, they noticed that there was a huge spike in the regular ebb and flow up and down of these EMF signals. And then having overlaid the data, the scientists discovered that spike occurred 10 to 15 minutes after the first airplane hit the Twin Towers on 9/11. And so that's very new for a lot of people, even though that event was 11 years ago. They had that information didn't get out, but what they discovered, it was 15 minutes after the time it took the information to circle the Earth with the the information media that we have now. So the only thing they could attribute this to is the outpouring of human emotion with the exact electromagnetic frequencies as the Earth. So they feel like it was human emotion, the outpouring of anger and fear and lots of compassion and concern that caused this actual spike in the Earth's fields. And Greg goes on to say, now they've demonstrated that we can actually consciously, on days where people come together in consciousness, like International Peace Day, create a similar spike, but come at it from the perspective of that we are so interconnected through the power of the heart that we can create, this impact on Earth that has more of a peaceful and a calming effect on people all over the world. So that's one approach we use from the scientific, but we also brought Native indigenous teachers from around the world into the film to talk about the fact that, hey, we've known this all along. We know that we are part of everything, and just because now you scientists can prove it, it's really nothing new. So we had a wonderful speaker, the head of the Eskimo tribes and Inuit shaman, talk about it, as well as some of the leading spokespersons for some of the tribes in North America. So we came at it from two different angles to say this is both old and new information converging together.
Why is all of this so important to you? What in the world happened in your life that flipped the switch that said, I got to get involved in this? I mean, it just seems like for some it's like, oh, there's no career in this. There's no life living in this.
Well, it was something that happened in some senses gradually, but in another sense there was one of these big wake-up moments that people talk about. I knew that, to really come at this whole process of living life consciously and creatively worked better from the heart. My clients and I were working with the principles of the law of attraction, and a lot of the things that, I mean, if you really dig into it, it's a lot about the integration of heart and mind. But what was being presented in public was, if you think the right things and say the right affirmations in your mind, things will change. And that wasn't really happening. And so at the time, I was taking clients to sacred sites in different places, both in Sedona, close to where I live, and some of the sites in North America. Then we ventured out into going to Glastonbury in the UK, and I thought, well, let's just do a little movie about what had never done a movie. I just thought it was going to be a promotional video so I could show people, this is what happens to you, my wonderful clients, when we go into these places and you transform. So that was the idea, not knowing anything about filmmaking, or wasn't really my plan. But when the wake-up moment was when the footage started coming back from the editor, and here I am talking in my own video that evolved into a full-length, I can say now, award-winning documentary film. I saw myself, and I look like a deer in the headlights, and I said, this is a wake-up call, because the only thing moving in me was my mouth. The rest of me was frozen and looked scared to death. So I thought, okay, I have to do this. This is giving me a big sign. I need to do some really deep level of heart work, because I'm going to talk about compassion and love and connection. I can't look like I'm scared to death. And so that really put a stop to the project when I went, to call in as, who's my next teacher? I'm ready. Show up. And so then I met a number of people that ended up subsequently in the film. And it turned into be, rather than a documentary sort of travel promotional piece, this full-length feature film that just won last weekend the best inspirational documentary film in a film festival that I was in.
Well, I know that as I do these programs, I even acknowledge publicly that this is a form of therapy for me. So,
yeah. Exactly.
So I'm hoping that I can certainly become better at what I'm doing, but also become a better person in the process. And yet there are those moments, even when I was driving into work today, where I had one of these moments where I felt like pulling over and just banging my head against the steering wheel, because it was like, that is not the way we behave, even internally, even in the mind, towards other people on the road. You don't do that. I mean, because thoughts become actions in many instances. It's not that I would physically necessarily carry out any action, but that thought form goes out and then creates something. And it's in those moments when I think, you're not so enlightened after all, are you?
Yeah, a little. just kept bring yourself back into check and balance, and then move on.
Yeah, I got to grab that line and tether myself a little bit better in that respect. But again, we all go through that, I know. And I know that when I start watching many of these movies that I see, and we are... I have to say, Rana, that, and I'm sure that in addition to people being able to go to sacredjourneyoftheheart.com, both looking at the trailers, they can even watch the movie or even purchase a DVD of the movie for their own. I also have gotten rid of the 195,000 channel service that I used to have, and now I utilize a lot of the online on-demand stuff so that I'm more selective. So I watch a lot more documentaries than I ever did. And I'm coming across more documentaries and more people like yourself who are really working towards, quite honestly, making a real difference in this world and a difference. And I think, too, that there's a difference between what you're doing and what someone out there who is dissatisfied with maybe their partner, their job, their situation, and saying, I want things to change. But they don't have any idea what they want in exchange for what they're in right now. You are presenting possibilities, even if it's just through a process. And I want to talk a little bit now about one of those processes called radical forgiveness that is spoken about in the movie. Now, I listened to the presentation. I listened to the four steps. And I have to say that I liked what I was hearing, step one, step two, step three. But when I first started hearing step four, and we'll go through them maybe, my first reaction was, you people are crazy. If you think that any human being who's been through the kind of stuff that Rana, even you have been through, that you could actually have somebody reach that point of doing what you're asking them to do in step four. I mean, my gosh, they've been through such trauma in childhood, and this happened, and that happened, and you're asking them to do that, really? And then as I listened more, and the light went on. Oh, I see. And it made perfect sense. So first of all, tell me about how you became involved with radical forgiveness, and then describe for us what it is.
Well, that was the wake-up call when I said, I am obviously not in my heart, and I think part of me knew that. I was just hoping nobody else would notice it. I could put a camera on you, and the answer is right there. And so that's when I know it's time to grow. I say, okay, universe, I'm ready for the next teacher. And just around that same time, one of my clients gave me the book, Radical Forgiveness, and she said, I think you'll enjoy this. Well, it was the third time someone had given me the book, and the first two times I didn't bother to open the book because I thought I had forgiven. I'd been in 15 years of conventional therapy, and just so your listeners know, I was dealing with a prolonged childhood abuse from age 3 to 13, so sexual abuse, emotional manipulation, all kinds of stuff. And so I was working real hard at it, you know, to heal and to be a good, you know, present, awake, alert mother to my four children. And so, you know, I had thought I'd done all this forgiveness work. I was a spiritual person after all. I knew everything had a purpose. Mm-hmm. So then the third time it came to me, I said, I better open this book. And I started reading it, and it aligned with everything that I had done and knew about, except for the one line that struck me that Colin Tipping, the originator of this fantastic system, said is, you cannot heal what you don't feel. And so most of the therapeutic work I had done was in the realm of, you know, talking through things or all kinds of metaphysical ABCs of healing where people were doing things to me and for me, like, you know, I did some kind of shamanistic retrievals and EMDR and all kinds of things. But I really hadn't gone into feeling what had gone on, not to re-experience the trauma, not to re-traumatize, but just allow myself to dive into that. So then when I immediately said, I know this is where, when I call in for a teacher and here he is, I know where it's to go. So I went out to meet Colin Tipping, do a workshop with him on the East Coast, and then I saw how life-changing it was to go through his actually five steps of radical forgiveness. We might not have mentioned the fifth, which is the integration of the work. So would you want me to describe the five steps?
Yeah, let's go through the five steps basically.
Okay. So it's, and this is what made the difference in me. And if your listeners are interested in seeing what it looks like, because people say, well, what's in it for me to do this emotional work that's kind of messy and I have to revisit some painful things, I'd rather move on. Go to YouTube and look for Rana Prince. That's Rana with two N's, Rana Prince before and after. And you'll see, you know, you don't even have to get the film. You can see the first couple minutes of the film on my website, but you'll see the difference that we literally had to go in and reshoot every one of my scenes after I went through the process of radical forgiveness and some heart math things we can talk about also. The step one is telling the story. You know, just telling your story, what Les Collins said, what happened? You know, and of course, I had told my story a lot of times, but this is, you know, from a different perspective in radical forgiveness that we'll get to. So you tell the story. Step two is feel the feelings, and I demonstrate how to do this on camera. It's a very powerful scene in chapter two, and I'm not an actress, so I was really feeling the feelings. And step three is you start to collapse the story to take away the things that you interpreted about a story. And so then when you interpret and you make up bigger stories from your personal story, then you start to recreate it in your life. Like, for example, if your father left your mother when you were little, the story you might interpret is all men abandon women. And so then you go out your life and you live that out over and over. So step three is really sort of like a research project. You know, you separate the facts from the fiction. And what other bigger stories did I invent that are still showing up in my life? And you just look around and the results of your life and you'll see that. And then step four that you mentioned is a bit difficult for most people to get their mind around in the beginning is you reframe that story, and instead of seeing it from a victim perspective, like I can't have, you know, men leave me, I'm a victim of that, you start to see maybe there was a purpose in this, that there's, you reframe it and say, my soul created this experience so that I could learn and grow, and shifting my perspective gives me a whole new, you know, immediate insight into the energy and the emotion of gratitude and appreciation, where you can say, oh, these men are continuing to leave me so that I can heal that original wound of my father leaving me and all the stories I made up about being mistreated, that men are mean, that men are unreliable. I mean, there's got to be a lot of women out here who have experienced that. When you reframe that story, instead of feeling victimized by your past, then you feel you can open your perspective and open your heart, as I say, for a new direction and be grateful that these people loved you so much that they gave you these experiences so you could finally come back home to yourself, because it ultimately becomes that you've been abandoning yourself over and over again in this particular scenario. And when that shift happens and it really kicks in, and it does, your whole energy changes. As you can see in my before and after, the way I look changed. I literally lightened up, lost weight, my skin got better, you know, and so because I no longer had to hold on to the heaviness and the burden. And the fifth step, which is about the integration. We usually do something to move the energy and to you know, speak, say some of the processes out loud, and just to allow that shift to really come in on a physical level. So that's it in a nutshell. And as Colin says, you know, when we're saying there's really nothing to forgive, and in my case it was childhood sexual abuse, as he says, the mind can't handle it. It just says there's no way. There can't be that, you know, I can be grateful to my father on that spiritual level. Humanly, that was wrong. It was painful. It should not have happened, and it would have been nice if someone intervened. But on a spiritual perspective, I know that, you know, I can be in gratitude to my father. It's very obvious in my case. I'm out here teaching about this and making a difference and reaching people all over the world. So it's pretty easy to draw that line of conclusion of where the gift was in that early painful life experience.
Well, now, there is an aspect of it too that if I saw this wrong in the movie, I'll have to go back and watch it again. But my understanding was that in spite of the fact that you go through, especially step four, that doesn't take the perpetrator off the hook.
Right. That's correct.
So how do you juxtapose? And again, this is, now we're dealing in the mind here, but how do you juxtapose forgiveness for what happened and for the perpetrator versus not letting them off the hook? How does that work together?
The way that works is having the ability to hold the two perspectives at once. Colin talks about it like a two lenses, like a glasses. You know, one side of the lens is the human perspective that says if we're aware of something wrong going on in the world, our obligation, our responsibility is to take action and for that person to be made and to stand accountable, because there is a code of conduct and moral human behavior that we are all subject to in this world. But in the spiritual perspective, on the other side of the other lens, is the understanding that, you know, if you look back on a number of experiences in life that at the time seemed difficult and horrible, later with some distance and time, you say, you know, there was a purpose to that. And if you really think back on it, you know, there was a purpose to, you know, every experience, that if you decide to use it as a as an impetus to grow, you can see that as a gift. So it's the bridging both perspectives that can be a little bit hard at first, you know, but when you really get into the practice of it, it becomes easier and easier to say, yes, you're still accountable, and but at the same sense, I can be grateful that I had the experience because I now have a new perspective. And the best part is I no longer draw those same repetitive experiences to me in my life because I've shifted at the quantum level.
It sort of takes us back to a little bit to the whole aspect of thought forms, because if you're still in that old thought process, then again, you know, you're drawing all those things to you. You still have the physical manifestations. You know, you talked to, you said that, you know, after the fact, you know, you lost weight, your skin cleared up, different things of this nature. You looked happy. You looked like, you know, you were a person who was enjoying her life. Whereas as long as you're holding on to that stuff, you continue to manifest that. So it seems to me, the other question that came to me, actually it came to someone else who's seen the movie, and that was in terms of going over this stuff. Now, I've been through numerous intensives in my life, starting in the 80s. I went through Life Spring. I've been through several other programs in the 90s. Great programs. I enjoyed them. I would still, you know, have people, I would still encourage people to go through them regardless. But the question that came up after this person was had watched the film was, oh, how many times do we have to revisit this stuff? You know, I know that this happened and it was traumatic and blah, 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 blah. And so it's like, oh my gosh, now Rana is saying we got to go through this again. You know, how do you respond to someone who's basically kind of tired of revisiting this stuff?
Well, I can relate to it, first of all, because I, you know, used to say when something came up, I'm like, oh, you know, smack the forehead and go, I can't believe I already did this again. Why is it happening again? And then secondly, the thing is, it's about really looking at the results in your life. If you're at a deep place of inner peace, your relationships are working, your jobs are working, you know, you're doing what you love and loving what you do, and your car is taken care of, and these are all symbols of our larger self, our soul, our car is working, our internet connection, our phone. Everything's fine. You don't have, there's no reason to go back and look at it. The reason that people come to me for coaching and why I look at it when something comes up is there's something that's out there reflecting to me. It's not quite healed. There's some part of the emotional, what Dr. Donald Baxter, my co-producer, chiropractor with many other degree, says is there's an energy cyst that forms around an unexpressed emotion. In the case of our film, we say, you know, the thought forms are out there, they're getting energized by the emotion, which is in my perspective, my experience, much more powerful than the thought form. The thought form repeats over and over because the emotional cyst is encapsulated inside of our body. A lot of times, you know, if you can see things, I'm sure you've talked about it on our show, the correlation between physical symptoms and unhealed emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So if ever, you don't have to revisit it, absolutely not, if everything's working fine. But if something comes up and you're on the path of self-exploration and you know, conscious illumination, you want to look at it and say, well, where does this originate? Where does it come from?
Yeah.
And that's the wonderful thing about radical forgiveness. You don't have to go, well, I'm going to go right back to that childhood pain. I can give you another quick example about how, you know, how in a daily life this might work.
Mm-hmm.
That would be helpful.
Sure. Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Okay, so I have my four children. My oldest is 23, and he has a child of his own. So he started a little early in life. He's got a four-year-old, which is a wonderful joy to me. And he came over the other day because I had my little set play date with my grandson. And my 23-year-old son stood in the entry to my home and said, you know, Mom, you haven't been very consistent about keeping these dates with my son for the last 2 years. It seems like you're always canceling and changing. Now, in the back of my mind immediately goes to be defensive because for the 2 years that he was going through trying to finish college and have this child and get married, I was watching this little boy at the drop of a hat. So I could have gotten defensive, but instead of that, just took some breaths. I said, I hear what you're saying. I will, you know, look at that situation. I went back into my own radical forgiveness process after, well, you know, I was done playing with my grandson and said, what is that showing myself about me. I could have jumped to anger and defensiveness and said, "What the heck are you talking about?" what we normally would do. I just took a moment to say, "What's it reflect about me?" And I got to see something really important. But there were some things that are important to me about my practice that I was not being consistent at. And so he was just showing that to me, mm-hmm. reflecting that to me, as I say, lovingly, so I could take the opportunity to go back in. Well, there's, I could spend a lot of time in drawing that back to childhood, but it was about my life right now. So I got to that place. I allowed myself to feel indignation. How could you? and anger. And, I didn't bypass that part, which I had been doing in my spiritual practice before. Don't go there. It's a low vibration. That's called a spiritual bypass, and it keeps the unexpressed emotions stuck in the body. So in an appropriate time and context, I allowed myself to feel that, held the mirror up to myself and said lovingly, "Oh, this is showing me where I wasn't tending to myself consistently." And then I was able to genuinely, in the process of doing the 13, and this is a worksheet process, 13 steps of radical forgiveness, love and forgive my son instead of holding a grudge. And these are the things that end relationships oftentimes, when they're built up, and we never really tend to our inner terrain. So for me, it's a lifestyle, and it keeps me on track with everybody, everyone that I'm in connection with that really matters.
Well, it seems to me as though I think it would be beneficial, at least for everyone, to at least have an opportunity to see the film. It's Sacred Journey of the Heart, and that's also the website, sacredjourneyoftheheart.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are talking with filmmaker Rana Prince of the film Sacred Journey of the Heart, and we're kind of getting in depth here in our therapy session here on the program. I want to thank you again for sharing your time and your story with us, as well as with everybody who sees the movie as well, again, which is entitled Sacred Journey of the Heart, and it's available at that website, sacredjourneyoftheheart.com. It's an interesting process that we as humans go through. I mean, you talked about this just before we went to break about, how we hold on to stuff and hold on to stuff, and we sort of keep a list of transgressions of others in that regard, and that it doesn't do us. As a matter of fact, the transgressor, as we pass judgment, doesn't hurt the transgressor at all.
Right.
It hurts us. That list is what weighs us down. And I know that in interviews that I have been doing over the last 30, 35 years, in talking with various people about the various physical manifestations, you mentioned this as well, about how, those kinds of things pop out when we start holding on to these kinds of things. The most profound one for me is individuals who have excessive weight gain, and I mean excessive, to the point where it's amazing that they're still alive. I remember hearing that in most cases is their putting up the cushion, the defense mechanism, if you will, the protection around themselves so that people can't hurt them. The problem is they're hurting themselves, But we do that in many different ways. When you, and I'm sure that you have been out promoting this film, going to various places, meeting all kinds of different people. Tell me about the kinds of diverse reactions that you have been getting from people.
Well, I get a number of reactions. There is the very intense emotional scene in Chapter 2 where I'm demonstrating the steps of radical forgiveness, where it was not an easy decision to put that in the film. We were doing it through the process of a board game that Colin invented, and I also have available on my website. It's called Satori, which means awakening. And I go through the process of the step 2, feeling my feelings and the anger that I had bottled up inside towards the person that had abused me. And so in my spiritual practice, anger wasn't allowed because that was low vibration. You might be aware of the Hawkins scale, so it's a low vibration, fine. But the only thing that's problematic about that is that when it gets stored in the body. I go a little step further and express hatred, which a lot of spiritual people, there's sometimes a literal gasp in the audience. Because, you know, the reality is when that's happening to a child over and over, the child's going to feel hatred toward the abuser. So I went out on a limb and said, I didn't plan it. It came out though in the course of actually playing the game. So I have some people that watch the film, and I think it's because they're triggered by unhealed experiences, that get up and leave. And usually there's, you know, one or two, sometimes a few more, that just, they can't stay in the film. It's too upsetting or too much against their beliefs that we shouldn't express these things. Then I have other people that come, most of the rest of the people are so grateful because this impacts 3 out of 5 women, and some of the statistics say 1 out of 6 men. So I have most of the rest of us people coming up to me with great gratitude for showing a different way to come out of the state of chronic victimhood, and also congratulating me on my courage, and then the vision to put this film together, not knowing anything about filmmaking, and to present it in such a beautiful way, because my story is only in chapter 2. We have all kinds of other stories, you know, mm-hmm. vignettes and people that are talking about, you know, the reality of the heart, like you mentioned Greg Braden and Dr. Joe Dispenza and Mary Morrissey, our film's narrator, who's a fantastic teacher and a global leader. So it's really, you know, that people who can't stay and watch it because they're not ready, and those who are just most are grateful, and then those who are excited and say, I want more. Where do I get more? So then we can lead them to the website and say, here's 25 hours of more material about how you do this transformational heart-based living that you can look into at your own pace.
Well, I have to say that when we got to that part in the film, I just sat there just amazed that it was part of the film, for starters. But by the same token, and with all due respect to those who can't sit through it, how often will you sit through a television program or any other movie or the news and you watch somebody acting out in anger, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, and they'll do it on live TV. I don't know that I would put necessarily the programs like Jerry Springer in that category.
Exactly, yeah.
But it just seems like, wait a minute, there's a little hypocrisy here. You have to understand that this is part of what is who and what we are. Now, in terms of dealing with these emotions, and again, this is only a part of step 2, feel the feelings, in the Radical Forgiveness Program, how I know that there is an actual time frame put on this, but how long are you going to spend feeling those feelings? What is the trigger that says, okay, I've gone far enough, I can stop now?
Well, that's one of the things that I hear a lot, is people who are holding a lot of unexpressed emotion that we call the difficult emotions. They get afraid that this is a defense pattern. If I start feeling these things, I'll never stop, or I'll get lost into it, or how long. That's what made the difference for me in Radical Forgiveness, because I had the same question, too. I went through some processes that would just leave me broken open, and I'd be laying on the couch for a week with 4 kids to deal with, and I'm like, I can't do that. But with Radical Forgiveness, there is, in every single process that Colin has developed, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. So you never finish a process, you know, sort of left open in the process of the game. You know, it's a spiral-based game where you just keep moving along. If you're doing a worksheet, you feel the feelings, you let them express, and then you go to the next step that says, you know, you're acknowledging that nobody can make me feel these feelings. My feelings are mine, and I choose them. You don't have to be willing to believe it, but you just keep moving along. I did a 21-day program that Colin developed about forgiving your parents, and when I got to do the 21 days for my mother, I got really stuck in that process of being angry at her because I'd done a lot of work around my dad. So I called my coach, and I said, I need to stay angry at my dead mother for about another 5 years. This isn't enough, you know, these 7 days. And she said to me, well, Ronnie, you can do that if that's what you need to do, but I want you to do is keep moving the energy, and that's that important, you know, movement of the energy. Go outside and, you know, stomp the ground, do a mandala piece of artwork, read your letter, your victim letter in the mirror, scream. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And I kept moving that energy out of my body from the perspective, not that it was wrong, that it was bad, and this is what's different, because when I first met Colin, I stood in front of him saying, I'm not, with my arms crossed, by the way, I'm not going to do this, Colin. I've been in the workshops where I had to beat on things with a bat, and all you ended up with is a bunch of justifiably angry women. He said, do it anyway. This is different. The perspective and the difference is that we're moving the energy not because it's bad, but that just it's been stuck. And so after a couple of days, I was able to move on. So that's a good question. But with radical forgiveness, there's no reason to have to wallow in that, you know, depending on where, you know, how intensely you're going into it. It's just really diving into it, which is part of our theme of the film. Dive into it, tune into what's there, and then lighten up. So that lighten up part is important. You're not going to stay down there in the pit, you know, of pain, because you don't have to.
Yeah.
The process takes you through it really quickly and easily.
I think one of the things that I guess an individual would have to remember is why they chose to go through it in the first place. And that was to get free of the stuff, to move on, to so that they could make the other parts of their life work. And you have done that. I want to go back a little bit to something you had mentioned about, you know, you were teaching about the law of attraction and so forth. And we've had many people on the program talking about that as well. And even when it first came out, and I have the DVD at home of The Secret, and I've watched it a couple of times. It's been a while. I started hearing criticisms that there's some parts missing. But at the same time, I got to thinking, well, I don't know that there are any parts missing per se, as much as it seems to me like the focus is a little off kilter, because everything that I have gleaned from Sacred Journey of the Heart says to me that though if I want $1 million and a fancy car and a big house and all those kinds of things, I could certainly make those happen. But is that really the purpose of my life and my work? Or is that something I'm being told because I'm an American and I should be going after the American dream? Another one of those, I'll call them illusions. Because one of the things that was stated it was that everybody does not want the same thing. It's not like there isn't enough for everybody. It's that we don't all want the same things. But again, it came back to things. And you're not talking about things in the movie.
Well, we're not, because when it comes down to it, things are not what gives us a sense of peace and satisfaction in our lives. As I say in the film, it's the quality of our relationships. It's whether we really have this authentic communication and a heart-based connection.
Yeah.
People are not on their deathbed wishing they had more cars and more money. It's a deep regret for not having made that intimate personal connection with the most important people, and that's why we're really focusing on the heart and how do we do that, because people have lost contact with that. And one of the things we talk about in the film that also proves our interconnection is that if you and I were in the same room, my heartbeat could be measured in your brainwave and vice versa. So we really are connected. It's just that we've sort of shut off that intuitive, you know, heart-based feeling. I mean, we still have it. Someone comes into a room and we don't even see it, but we feel something kind of creepy sometimes, and that's someone coming in with, you know, a real pent-up anger or, you know, who's got a lot of issues, we would say. But it's a lot of people have said to me after the film, this is what I have been searching for since The Secret. I've heard that many, many times, because we say in the last chapter of the film, in Chapter 7, here are the tools and the teachings of the heart, and we give people a number of things that they can start doing. I have a thing called a 360-degree review that I developed that all brings everything on every level in 7 concentric circles back to our own heart, so we can really examine what it is we're seeing. So people really appreciate that, and saying it's, you know, it's really the feelings connection that come first, and that's what I developed called the law of confluence. That feeling builds connection between people. The heart creates wholeness in the world, and love manifests abundance. You know, and that we're in this middle of this paradigm shift where we realize we can't think our way through the problems anymore,
mm-hmm.
which is what's so exciting. It gets people excited in watching the film, because there is a way to create more, you know, community, interdependence, like you talked about, to come together for more creative solutions for what we're facing as today, that Greg Braden talks about in the film.
We're talking with Rana Prince, the filmmaker of the film that we've been discussing throughout this program, and it is entitled Sacred Journey of the Heart. The title is is interesting because when I first started watching the movie, or actually when I finished the movie and I look at the title again, I thought, shouldn't it be Sacred Journey to the Heart, you know, at first? Right. And then I began to realize that, well, no, they weren't trying to take you to your heart per se. They were trying to show you that this is the journey that the heart will take you on, in a manner of speaking. Have I seen correctly?
that's part of it. But I also have another secret about the title, which this gets into one of the things I'm passionate about, which is numerology, because I understand, you know, and do a lot of numerology work with people. It's very confirming, and the more than that, it can tell us the next steps. But when I looked at the numerology, the title, Sacred Journey of the Heart, I'm using Pythagorean numerology where A is 1 and B is 2. It's pretty absolute, almost called a science. The title equals 111, which is about balance. It's about moving beyond duality and into the field of confluence, a weaving together of many things. And I knew that that vibration created a magnetic field, because sometimes people ask, well, how did you get all these people in the movie, like Greg Braden and Mary Morrissey and Colin and Joe Dispenza? Well, a lot of them didn't think too hard about it. I told them the title, a little bit about it, was what it was about, and they said, okay. And
I'm
personally think it's because of the magnetic energy and the intention, we could also call it, that I put behind, you know, making this a much bigger project than I originally envisioned. So that's my other secret part of it.
Well, you've certainly gathered some of a lot of the big names, if you will. We've had the pleasure of having Greg. We've had Howard Martin from Heart Math on many times, and I just find it extraordinary that many of these people and organizations, they are connected, even if it's loosely. They know of one another. They have worked together with one another over the years, even though they're off doing their own independent things, because they all understand, just as you do, about our interconnectedness, and that there is, you know, that we're here to support each other. I kind of use the analogy, especially when it comes to this transition that we're going through, this paradigm shift that we have been talking about for 7+ years. We're on a lifeboat, and we have this giant lifeboat. It'll hold 7 billion people, by the way. And we want everybody aboard. However, there is a catch. You have to be willing to let go of the old ways of doing things.
Yeah.
Because they don't work. Just look around you. They don't work. If you're not willing to let go, that's fine. There's no judgment there. You can't come on the lifeboat, but there's because we're not taking these old ideas with us. And so you may rule the remains of civilization as it appears today, if you wish, or you can join us, because everybody has something to contribute. And I think that's one of the things that I'm beginning to understand. It's sort of helping me with some of those moments out on the roadways driving around, that every person has something to contribute. It kind of goes back to James Redfield in his Celestine Prophecy message about how each of us has a message for somebody else, and that we are responsible to deliver that message. Now, whether that person receives it and takes it in, that's not our responsibility, but we have to deliver it. And so, and that's why I've always felt that there's such great loss of potential when it comes to warfare. My gosh, what could these people have done if they hadn't been dragged into this experience? Of course, then I'm drawn back, Rana, to what you've already shared about radical forgiveness, and in terms of the experiences that we choose for the reasons that we choose them. And so I almost have to modify that and say, well, yeah, but how do I know that that wasn't why they came here in the first place?
Well, we can always search and find deeper meaning in, you know, things that are difficult in our lives. We can also find them in the things that are beautiful and the things that connect us. And, all these people that are out there, yourself included, everyone is delivering this message. We are all cooperating and connecting. And, you know, I did a telesummit on the topic with the film speakers and a whole bunch more, and I got to interview Bruce Lipton, who runs in these same circles, and he talked about the reality of our connection also. One of the best explanations I heard, and, you know, taking my film out, was from Dr. Michael Beckwith, who is also a leader in this area, and he said, we're living in a world where there's really two worlds operating at once. It's like a condensate form in particle physics, where you can actually have the old one particle vibrating at this level and another one right on top of it in the same space, occupying the same space, but a very different vibration. And he was talking about this right after the verdict of the man who shot the African-American
young. Oh, yes, down in Florida, yes.
Yeah, so he was talking about it to his congregation right after that verdict, and he said, if we understand that the new paradigm is here, we're still seeing evidence of the old, we're occupying the same space, and the turning point, and we talk about it in the film, is what do I choose to do with my heart? How do I manage the quality of my life, not the quantity and the stuff and the things, but how do I make those authentic connections? So a teenager like Trayvon Martin doesn't get to the point, you know, where he's out cruising the streets and alone. He's being, you know, he's more, you know, maybe that's not a good example, but, you know, the people really are listening to each other and looking at each other and caring and paying attention so we don't end up with these acts of violence. It's the old and the new existing at the same time. It's not very comfortable, but if you start to see it from that perspective, it's really powerful when we make our own choice of how we behave in our own lives.
And these people also may have chosen to be that lesson to show us, yes, that these two worlds are in existence, and one of them eventually will pass away. I mean, they cannot, I don't know this from a physics standpoint, but I would think that they can't exist indefinitely together. One of them eventually dissipates.
Yes.
And I would think it's the one that's, I think the word is, that's in entropy. I think that's the right word. Or devolving, I know, is another word that's been created. Devolving as opposed to evolving. Barbara Marx Hubbard has shared, and she was actually one of our early guests on this program back in 2007, who talked about this whole transition and that we're all going through, and referred to it as birth pangs. I mean, you know, the mother goes through, and I have no clue as to what it's like, okay? I can only speak from third-hand evidence. The mother goes through some pretty horrendous pain and so forth. But in the end, what pops out is this beautiful new human being to experience the world. Well, that's kind of what we're going through now, and some say that, you know, the birth pangs have only just begun, and, you know, who knows where we are in the process, how far along we are, and whether it's an 8-day labor period and we're only in day one, first hour,
right?
Or we're somewhere in the middle. But be that as it may, here we are. I've also heard it said too, Rana, that those of us who are here can be looked upon from a universal perspective as heroes, because we chose to be here at this time because of the transition, the challenges, and so forth. Your observation.
Well, I'm aware of that too, and I think anybody who is here and playing any part whatsoever, whether it's the mother on the corner with the sign and a little child, you know, some people could say she's exploiting her child and asking for money, but she's here showing up and doing what she needs to do. For a lot of people, it's just getting by, and that's heroic in these times. For others of us, we're doing our best to spread a different message that, you know, we may have bought into a system that says transition and birth is painful, because there are ways of going through this process without it having to be so horrific. You know, I learned how to birth a child without any pain in 20 minutes. That's a new paradigm. Do you think the medical model is telling us how to do that? No. But it's possible. We don't have to buy into the old system, and that's what the paradigm shift is about. And I think the work is, you know, tending to the emotions, tending to our heart. Our bodies will take us there if our heart doesn't. And, you know, Joe Dispenza talks about that. You know, when we can either change in stress or we can change in under choice. And that's a big part of the movie, too, is what way are we going to choose to do this? So, yes, it's not like I get up in the morning and have all, you know, smelling the coffee and the roses. I am dealing with stuff, too, real stuff, too, and my emotions. But it's a lot easier hanging out in this paradigm where I consciously choose to say, you know, I'm coming from the heart. Is much easier. My life works better, and I meet a lot fewer bumps in the road than I used to.
I was digging through some file boxes the other day. I came across a micro cassette player and a tape in it. And I had bought this thing back in 1992 for the purposes of recording the daily activities that I needed to carry out at the job I was doing, at the radio station I was working for. In other words, I would basically be dictating to myself, okay, note to chief engineer, we need to have the transmitter looked at because blah, 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 blah. Note to staff that the bathrooms need to be cleaned, blah, blah. And I was listening to this, and some of the things that I had to do, and I thought, wow, I had only been in this business for about 12 years, and I'm listening to this dictation, and I'm going, wow, I was pretty darn efficient back then. I mean, I was really kind of amazed. It's like, really? That's me saying that? I mean, with what sounded like great authority. But I also went through a phase early on in that where I ruled with an iron fist. Now, that didn't last long, and I refer to that as my Hitlerian period.
Okay.
And it didn't work, and I got my comeuppance one day when one of my staffers, I asked one of my staffers to do something, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I need to find out what's going on here. Why won't you do it? He says, because you're telling me to do it.
Oh, boy.
And I'm thinking, okay, then I need to rephrase this. So I rephrased it in the context of it needed to be done because the floors were dirty or the client was asking for it or whatever. And he, okay, I'll do it. And it was at that point that I realized that there was no way I was ever going to manage staff again from the standpoint of being a superior.
Right.
And so what I found was, as I began to look at that and I began to look at the places that I frequented, stores, restaurants, et cetera, just like you, every single person, and this goes back to the interconnectedness, every single person doing whatever job it is, and I've done some of them. I was a dishwasher in a restaurant. I delivered newspapers. I worked in a photo lab processing film and photographic paper and so forth. That they all are serving a purpose at that level, and that they all deserve the same respect, regardless of, and I'll refer to it as station.
Right.
I have a real hard time with this whole class system. When I start taking a look at that aspect of the way people are treated, I live in an area here in Central California, where if someone was to observe, it's as if the people who work here at all of those, we'll call them lower station positions, they don't live here. They can't afford to. And they're here to serve those who can. And I look at that thinking, there's something wrong with that paradigm. There's something really wrong. Why can't the people who are working in those lower stations experience that which they are providing to those who live here? I often wonder when was the last time a maid or a cleaning person at a high-end five-star resort stayed at a five-star resort and was served like all of the others? Shouldn't we all have that opportunity? And so this is where the aspect of interconnectedness and mutual respect and appreciation for one another, regardless of what it is that we do. And it takes us back to that whole aspect of the heart. Can you elaborate a little more on that and from your perspective?
Well, and it's our responsibility, those of us who have this information, to really take the work of the heart out into the world and to practice it. You know, if we're the fortunate that we have people coming in and cleaning our home, you know, taking a moment to really, speak to these people instead of just ignoring them as the furniture, and to speak to people who are cashiers that we can have all of our wonderful food and produce to feed our family. So it's really, we have a higher degree of responsibility to pay attention and make a genuine connection with these people than if we were, in their position. And a lot of people are struggling. And Mike Booth, who is in the film, and he's one of the early supporters. He's a British gentleman who is develops this wonderful system called Orosoma that I'm a practitioner of. We won't go into it, but he says in the film, it really doesn't matter what your station is, if you're a physicist or you're a janitor, that we all have the opportunity to see the interconnection in our related roles and everything. And one of the things that didn't make it into the film, he went on to talk to me in the interview later, that there's this kind of an epidemic, and one of the dark sides of spiritual seekers and consciousness is to judge people according to whether they're awake or not. Mm. He says, who's to say? Maybe their sole purpose in this life, you know, is to be that person who's angry all the time, cutting us off on the highway, so that the rest of us can make some choices and wake up. And who's to say in some other time or place that that wasn't the enlightened scholar and master, and we were the ones sort of bumbling our way through. And that is a bit of an undertone, a lot of spiritual consciousness. And so I think that's a very important point that you make, you know, about it's not so much about equality, because we can see that's not part of our paradigm, but just the respect for where everybody is, and having no judgment around why they are where they are. And
yeah.
That's not an easy thing to do, especially among spiritual people. It's quite interesting to see that paradox.
It is indeed. I mean, unfortunately, there have been very few guests that this has happened with, but I've had it happen with at least one or two guests that I haven't had on my program because I couldn't get through the entourage. And I'm thinking, wait, who is this person that they have this level of security or protection, or I don't know what it is. What do these people think they're protecting this person from or for or what have you? This person's message is supposed to be, you know, you talk about spirituality and the heart and on and on and on. I mean, I've had, there's part of me that goes, I've been interviewing Greg Braden since the late 1990s. I've never had any problems getting through to him. I don't know if it's because of that. But then again, I've heard that he's been on hundreds of other programs too. So obviously he has not made himself inaccessible.
Right.
Whereas others, and it may not be the individual who's done this. It may just be the organization that has sort of surrounded them. And it's really kind of unfortunate in that respect. I ran into that too. And even within the religious communities, when I worked for 15 years in a Christian radio station. Greatest education I was ever paid for, and that sometimes would happen where, you know, I was told to get a hold of such and such a minister or pastor at a larger and larger church, whether it was in Phoenix or somewhere else, and it took quite a while to get through. And it's like, Jesus never had this, you know, people never had that much trouble getting through to Jesus, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think it always has to come back to the person that is, you know, they're I know they're thinking they're protecting, but there gets to be, and I've seen it, I'm sure you have, a lot of ego involved, the bigger your message is, potentially,
yeah,
with some people. And I've seen, you know, being in conferences with Greg, for example, people just, you know, hoard and hound that man. But
mm-hmm.
He's mastered the art of that too, where he said, excuse me, I'm talking to this person first, and when I'm done, I will talk to you. So
yeah,
he's mastered that. You know, but you have to, and at some level, when you're at his stature and some of the others, you've got to have someone shepherd you through the crowd that is, you know, everyone's trying to throw him a proposal or
mm-hmm.
something. And, you know, I've had a little bit of that when my film
yeah.
was showing for 4 weeks in the theaters. I had people giving me their business cards and wanting to pitch me on this and that. And it can go to your head pretty quickly, but, you know, if you stay grounded and centered in the heart, you really realize that, you know, everybody wants to get their message out and they want help. And so it's just mastering that art of, you know, interfacing with people in a way that is respectful, like Greg Braden does so beautifully.
I had the great privilege of actually, for the first time after probably 12 or 14 years, of actually meeting him in person down in Los Angeles during one of these events that was going on down there. I mean, it was quite literally... he turned, I introduced myself. He's, oh, it's great to put a face with a name and a
yeah.
voice. Shook my hand, and I could see that he was busy, that there were people that were clamoring for his attention. So I said, hey, great to see you. Hope we see you again. And I dropped back.
Yeah.
Because it was just one of those things. So, it is one thing I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing that he has been able to master that. And of course, each one of us in our own way has, as you say, that message. And I think that was one of the things that really struck me, especially working for 15 years as I did in Christian broadcasting. And I had a lot of issues with a lot of the doctrine and dogma that was coming down. And because I was a thoughtful person, I was a logical thinker, and a lot of that I was being told just didn't make sense to me. So I was asking questions, I began to try to be as respectful as I could. But my point is that people would come in, pay the money to be on the air, but they would provide me with materials that just the quality was so poor. And so I would do everything I could to clean up the program and clean up the material from an audible standpoint, because my perspective was, it is not my place to judge your message, but my place to make sure that the listener can hear your message and make up their own minds. And so when people have a message like that, and I go to different websites and I see different videos, for example, of different things, or I'll listen to some audio that they've posted on their website, and I'm going, I can't even watch this or listen to this because the quality is so distracting. Now, maybe someone younger than me who's used to all of that, no problem.
Right.
But the message is totally lost on me. Whereas I watch, for example, Sacred Journey of the Heart, and the production values are fantastic, to where I'm actually sitting there in my living room with Greg Braden or with Rana Prince or any of the other participants in the film, or experiencing the emotions that are going on the screen and so forth. And I think that says an awful lot. And what I'm kind of noticing as I get older and in this business is that, unfortunately, a lot of this is starting to slip by the wayside. And so messages are going to be, I think, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but messages are going to be lost.
Well, it's both a blessing and a curse if you look at it both ways, because my film is so beautifully done and it has a pace that allows people to take in the information, but they still like to go back and see the film four or five times.
So, yeah.
But the curse is I'm trying to get it out there still on the circuit of, you know, spiritually conscious people at the Science of Mind and places like Unity's and other communities, and they have seen such an onslaught of bad material. So you say, I have a documentary on consciousness and science, they say, yeah, you know, we don't do that anymore. So that's the challenge I'm up against, because there's been so many films that were anyone who had a camera thought they could make a movie. I knew better than that when I realized I had something really special. So I started to, you know, really hire some of the best out there in the business. Scott Servine, who did Debbie Ford's film The Shadow Effect, and also Austin Vickers' People versus State Evolution. Beautiful, beautiful imagery and production value on not much of a budget. Still, for me, it was a lot of budget, but that's been one of my biggest challenges, is getting this message out there and telling people this is a different film. This is an award-winning documentary with life-changing information that just doesn't tell you a lot of things. It shows you and suggests a variety of ways of how to apply it in your life. So, you know, I'm working in the positive sense that, you know, we just keep getting the message out, and the word is spreading, and people around the world. When I did the telesummit, people from every country of the world chimed in to our program, and because this is such a needed part of changing our sense of, you know, confusion or hopelessness, or, you know, just not what direction to go, not knowing the direction to go in. So I'm really happy to be able to provide an alternative message that's catching on around the world, and happy to share my film. You can see it on DVD on the website, Sacred Journey of the Heart, or stream it for 48 hours.
That's very cool. It's very cool. Hey, we're just about out of time here, and I know you have to run as well, but I have just a few more questions for you before we wrap up the program. And I do want to thank you so much for taking so much time with us here on the program. The first of three, who is Rana Prince?
Well, I'm just a regular person like everyone else out there that wanted to make a difference in the world. And I said, you know, I was on the corporate ladder for a long time as a corporate banker, and I said, this is not fulfilling my heart's purpose. And so I stepped off of the known path and decided to, you know, make a difference at an individual level in people's lives. And so that vision expanded to this wonderful film we've just talked about.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Well, my hope is that people really understand that we are so connected and that we have the power in our own hearts to shift out of the old place of victimization, that these bad things happen to me, and into an empowered state of conscious living where we know that we can absolutely harness the power in our heart to literally change the fields of Earth. And we show you how to do that in the film.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Well, as I just alluded to, we are powerful enough to create a collective shift in the Earth's magnetic field. And we're powerful enough to make a difference in someone else's lives just by noticing them and saying, you know, I see you internally. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people literally, without saying a word, change in front of my eyes and open up and feel better in just that moment. So we have the power to impact other people's lives, to make our own life more peaceful and purposeful, and then also on a global level to impact what's going on the planet.
So people can go to sacredjourneyoftheheart.com. They can order the DVD. They can actually watch it for 48 hours on the screen. And we look forward to seeing you in our neighborhood sometime soon with a screening of the film as well. And again, thank you so much for the time that you've given us here on the program.
Thank you for having me on. It's been really enjoyable with all these intriguing questions and comments. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, love to Lal.